these guys have earnings coming up next week.
Then you've got the labor. I mean, the labor here is tremendous. I mean,
15.3% is the number, which is alarming.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
Welcome to Tuesday afternoon, everyone. Steve Bertrand in the Skyline Studio here, WGN Radio Studios above the Chicago River. Welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch. We'll talk a little bit later about WeWork. You know, it's a place where if you don't have your own office, you'll go to WeWork. A lot of companies lease space from WeWork, too, but they continue to expand their footprint in the city. They're moving more into the Fulton Market area. Amy Guth will be here to talk about that. Emotional intelligence, your EQ, a little later in the program as well. But we want to start on Wall Street. John Najarian is here from CNBC and the Najarian Family Office. And, of course, his emotional intelligence is through the roof. So I'm glad he's taking time to join us today. John, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Hey, great to be back with you, Stephen. Thank you.
So President Trump was playing Father Christmas, it sounds like, a little bit today, right? He's putting a delay on these Chinese tariffs, he says, because he doesn't want to have an impact on the Christmas shopping season.
Yeah. You know, every once in a while he throws a lump of coal in there. And today it was, like you say, a present, certainly welcomed by people who had been sort of spooked not only by last week's activity, even though we didn't end up moving very much net on the week. We were up and down a ton last week. And part of that was exactly the opposite of what he did today, which is last week he put on additional tariffs that would kick in September 1st. Today he delayed a number of those tariffs, and the market loved the idea that there would be a delay to the implementation of those tariffs.
Okay, is there substance behind this decision? I mean, what happened? I know they talked yesterday.
Yeah, I think the president is sensitive to what Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader, is going through with Hong Kong right now. So the president, our president, probably realizes that he could press this advantage hard, but that might cause an oversized reaction to Hong Kong, which nobody wants. Surely, you know, those of us watching don't want to see those protesters
No.
hurt bodily, and yet that could happen just in the stroke of a pen or the press of a button. And if it did happen, the likelihood is that China would lose a very significant connection to the West, because that's part of this treaty and part of the handover process from Great Britain back to China. And it's supposed to run through, I think, 2047 or something like that, that they will not come down on them with an authoritarian rule, or they give up that more or less what is an Asian banking hub. So I think that was probably at the heart of why the president was able to negotiate with the Chinese leader to pull back on these tariffs, at least delay them.
So the president's easing the pressure on tariffs to make it a little easier for Xi to deal with the protesters in Hong Kong?
I think so.
Okay.
Because, again, if you press him too hard right now, he has the world of hurt that you and I have talked about ad nauseum as far as job losses and all the rest because of these tariffs. And more pressure on him, you know, I think somebody becomes more dangerous when they're really, you know, caged in or painted into a corner. And I think by giving him a little breathing room here, maybe we can get a little more breathing room on the tariff side as well, by him perhaps agreeing to finally make those agricultural purchases that they've promised, that the president has said they haven't followed through on up until now.
CNBC posted a story within the past hour, and they're quoting a Jim Chano, so I don't know, I'm sure you do, saying
yes,
that the president blinked here. What do you make of that?
It could be. It very well could be, because of, as you say, the potential that it could hurt the Christmas shopping season. Most of that stuff's been ordered already between you and me. And
trust me, look at my Amazon account. We know it's been ordered.
Yeah, it's been ordered, and otherwise it wouldn't make it to the stores by now. So on the one hand, it's not just about Christmas, because the stuff's already been ordered, and although paid for, or at least partially paid for, revolving credit and so forth being what it is, I got to believe that it wouldn't have completely ruined Christmas. But on the other hand, maybe he's paying attention to what Lighthizer, his trade negotiator, as well as Mnuchin are telling him and saying, look, you know, the Chinese, if you really paint them into a corner and make them fight, they will fight, but it might not be so good for you and for, you know, the American people right here.
You know, I have to say, John, and you're the expert by far, and I'm just an observer, but sometimes I think we try to find motives for what the president does, and they don't necessarily fit what's going on in the world. You know what I mean? Like, sometimes I think he might just do stuff.
True. Clearly, the president at times can be his own worst enemy. I mean, he has a host of enemies, but they're not the kind of enemies that kill you. They're the kind that just, you know, stab you with a pen with what they write about him and so forth. But he's his own worst enemy in many other ways, and perhaps one of those was when he just lashed out a week ago and said, okay, I'm going to go to 25% tariffs. How about that?
Right.
I'm sure none of his counsel told him to do that, but his gut told him to do that.
All right, talk to me about Hong Kong, because you touched on it earlier. And, you know, what happens if Hong Kong does go south? You mentioned the banking hub, but, you know, it's so much more than that, too.
Right. It is where that's their stock exchanges primarily for Chinese-listed stocks. That's where, you know, many of them are Hong Kong-listed, some of them certainly Shanghai, but many of them Hong Kong-listed. It is how China, a communist country, basically participates with capitalists. And if they lose that, that is a very significant problem for Xi Jinping, for the Chinese people, and for all those manufacturers, the businesses that are there. Everybody from Alibaba, which has not just a website, but production facilities for everything from movies to retail goods. So I think that this would be a big deal if that were to happen, and for the most part, we're hoping that can be averted if they can soothe these protesters.
I mean, we're both old enough to remember Tiananmen Square, and when you saw those military vehicles lining up in Hong Kong, it just gives you chills. It's a terrible thing, and I hope they can head that off in one way or another.
I do too.
On Wall Street, so retail was doing well with the tariff news. What are you watching today?
Well, today we were buying Mondelez. This is the parent company of Toblerone and Oreos and Ritz crackers. I mean, it's a whole bunch of brands, the dumbest name on the street. We were joking during the show that if you called it Ritz or Toblerone or Oreos, it would be so much better.
John, I'm still afraid to say it. I'm still afraid to say it out loud because I think I'm always wrong.
I'll tell you what you wouldn't be wrong with, though, if you bought that stock.
Yeah.
It's up over 30% year to date. People were buying upside calls today very aggressively out in September. So we added to an already long position for our clients in MDLZ.
John Najarian from CNBC and the Najarian Family Office. Look, and thanks for joining us today. I look forward to the next time.
I do too. Thank you, Stephen.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. All right, robots and their rights. Do robots have rights? It's something that it might sound silly at first, but it's something we will be confronted with if we're not already being confronted with it. And we'll talk about that in the second half hour. Right now, though, I don't know how robots would do when it comes to emotional intelligence. Maybe that's a question for Carrie Goyette. She's the CEO of Aperio Consulting Group and the author of The Non-Obvious Guide to Emotional Intelligence. Carrie, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Great. Thanks for having me, Steve.
Okay, so I was going to say we'll always have that over robots that will have emotional intelligence and they won't, but is that true?
That's a good question. You know, they're teaching robots to be more human-like. But yeah, there's a lot, you know, even with AI coming, data analytics, blockchain, you know, kind of all the new things that we're getting excited about, there's really a call for more emotional intelligence across the board, but especially with leaders.
And there's a statistic, I think, in your material that said people with a higher EQ tend to make more money, as much as $29,000 more than those with a lower EQ. Tell me about emotional intelligence, why that results in more money.
Yeah, Yeah, because we're just more effective. So people that ask for feedback, that have high emotional intelligence, they tend to, 90% of top performers tend to have higher levels of EQ. So they're identified as top performers. They're identified to kind of go up the corporate ladder. So they're just recognized for their skills, and they're compensated well for that.
Okay, so I'm not good at math, and I don't think there's anything I could have done to make me good at math. I really don't. Is it the same when it comes to emotional intelligence, or can you foster, if you are devoid of emotional intelligence at 13, can you become enriched with it at 28?
Actually, you can. And so we've done studies where we've done pre and post measurements, and you can actually increase people's emotional intelligence. Now, when you think about the personality as a whole, there are going to be parts of my personality that are more flexible and then parts of my personality that are less flexible.
Right.
And so, but the key is reading our environment and adapting as needed in order to achieve our outcome. And so there's a lot of great soft skills, and so they actually can be learned. It's just like, you know, working out. It's like a muscle. You have to work at it. It's a process, not a pill. And so the more you work at it, the more effective you become. And then the other core ingredients are you have to want to, and you have to be willing to be somewhat self-aware.
You mentioned being aware of your environment, and I think that's key too, because we think of emotional intelligence as being all from within, but it's really, it's outside, right? It's understanding other people more.
It is, and I think that's where that's kind of the interesting, non-obvious angle that I took in the book, is that people often think, oh, well, to be emotionally intelligent, I just need to manage my emotions, I need to be more empathetic. And the answer is not necessarily. It's about really understanding how the environment may be triggering you or enhancing you, and then also what's needed in that particular environment. Just like, you know, a surgeon, when they have a body on the table and they're getting ready to operate, you actually don't want them to be high empathy in that particular environment. But where the problem comes in is when they're, you know, in their clinics and they're seeing patients, or they walk in their front door and greet their family. If they continue to stay low empathy, that's where it can hurt them, which is why often surgeons have a higher divorce rate.
So how do you decide, or how do you learn whether you are emotional, you know, if you have a low emotional IQ or a high one? I mean, is it, it's self-awareness, but how do you come to that self-awareness?
Yeah, there's a couple different ways. Number one, you can ask for feedback. So you can do a 360 survey and get feedback from your peers, your manager, direct reports, friends, family. So you can find out that way. There are also emotional intelligence tests out there. There are a lot of really good ones out on the market. And so you can assess your own emotional intelligence and see where you score. And mostly, you know, emotional intelligence is a compilation of different, you know, core elements. So you may be high in certain areas and then low in others.
And one of your notes says that smart companies don't rely on employee goals for basing compensation. Companies try to do what they can. I have to set goals here, and I just hate it. I'm so bad at it.
So
tell me why you think that's not a great idea. I just really want to hear that.
Yeah, so goals are really good in environments like in operations and things that you already know how to do. Where they become not as helpful and actually can decrease innovation is when you're trying to either be innovative or creative or try something you haven't done before. And that's just because employees will see it as a threat. And so if my compensation is tied to it and it's something I haven't done before, the brain is pretty smart and it quickly assesses the odds. You know, that's why you look at most, you know, angel investors. They don't ever invest in one startup. They invest in 10 and hope that one out of the 10 will hit. Well, same thing when you're trying something new that you haven't done before. You're less, you know, the risk is much higher. And so when you tie people's their compensation to it, they will actually sandbag goals and make them easier to hit because of the fear of not hitting them.
My goal.
And so that's where goals work well in certain environments, but in innovative, creative environments, they actually will do the opposite.
My goal has been to have breakfast almost every day, and I've done very well at that. Carrie Goyette.
Okay, there you go.
The author of The Non-Obvious Guide to Emotional Intelligence. Thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. Orion Samuelson today is at the Illinois State Fair. We hope to catch up with him a little bit later. We'll see if we can get in between the corn dogs and the meat parfaits and all of that. I know he's being honored down there, so we'll hope to check in with O a little bit later today. If not, we'll hear from him tomorrow. Let's talk robots right now. On a phone line is David Gunkel, a professor of media studies at Northern Illinois University. He's got a book coming out about the rights of robots and the argument or the discussion that is facing us. David, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me.
So I want to start with something you said about the fact that the incursion of robots into our lives is already well underway. And the quote that I saw from you was that it's a slow but steady incursion. It looks less like Westworld and more like the fall of Rome. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, so the image we have of the robot invasion, if you want to call it that, comes to us from science fiction. And so we think of it as this kind of thing where the robots come from outer space with ray guns, or they rise up against us, and it's apocalyptic and it's all terrible and there's a lot of violence. It's more like the fall of Rome insofar as the robots aren't coming from outer space with ray guns, but they are slowly moving into our world in ways that are not necessarily perceptible, taking over all kinds of roles in our everyday life. And one day we're going to wake up and say to ourselves, my God, where did all the robots come from? And that's the slow incursion that I talk about.
You know, that sounds like the analogy of the frog. Put a frog in a pot of water, then turn the oven on or the stove on, and he won't know until it's too late that he's dead.
Yeah. And in fact, a lot of the robots are invisible. I mean, we often think of robots as having these mechanical bodies, right? And they move and look like humanoid things. But a lot of the robots in our world are algorithms that reside in the cloud, and we don't even know that they are there. They just control a lot of things with decision-making and recommendations, etc. And so this automation is taking place in very invisible ways that we can't necessarily see.
Okay, so how do you take those things that we don't necessarily see or don't even really maybe recognize as robots, and then transfer some form of social standing or some sort of entity worthy of rights? I mean, how do we get there?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So a lot of the items and artifacts that are coming into our world are slowly taking up social roles. So, for example, when you call customer service now, oftentimes you don't talk to a human being. You talk to a chatbot, which is programmed to respond to you in much the same way the customer service representative would have responded to you. So instead of a human being reading a script to you, it's a computer program like a Siri or something right, similar to that, that can respond directly to you from instructions encoded in its programming. So these things are interactive, interpersonal kinds of experiences. And we are interpersonal social creatures. And we treat things that are interpersonal with the same respect that we treat other persons. There's been a lot of experimentation done since the 90s that show that people will treat computers that are socially situated as if they were another person. So the question is, as these algorithms and robots and whatever come to be social and have social presence, how do we respond?
I was reading that there was a story, that, in fact, that sparked this conversation last week that said, I'm assuming white people, tend to treat white-looking robots more nicely or equally than we do black-looking robots. And by that, I mean the color, yeah.
Yeah, it's a really interesting study. It was done by a fellow named Christoph Bartnick out of Australia and a few of his colleagues. And they were trying to locate or at least ask the question whether or not we racialize computers and robots. We know that we do gender. We engender things.
That's true.
And he wanted to know whether or not we do the same with race. And his preliminary findings indicate that, yeah, we tend to project race onto artifacts when they are designed in certain ways. And he was looking at, for example, the fact that a lot of the robots that you see in both fiction and in reality tend to be white or metallic.
Yeah, you know, and when you started your answer, I wasn't on board because I just didn't think that way. But you're right. We do assign gender all the time. So why wouldn't we assign race in one way or another?
Yeah, we treat Siri as a she, right? We use the pronoun she. There was a robot that was created by Cynthia Brazil and available commercially for a while called Jibo, and Jibo was gendered he. In fact, the company shipped it and used the pronoun he with the robot. This is not small stuff. I mean, this engendering and this racializing, et cetera, all matter for us as social individuals and how we relate to others.
All right, I'm interested in what you call the relational turn then. So we assigned rights in before about by who you were, what you were, sort of you're a human, you have thoughts and a conscious, we give you rights. And you flip that now by saying not what you are, but really how you interact with me, and that might be how we assign a right. Did I get that correct?
Yeah, no, you nailed it. That's exactly right. And the example I use with my students is the family dog. At one time, and, you know, still legally speaking, dogs are property, right? My grandfather raised dogs to hunt. And when a dog was not able to hunt well, he did what we did with any kind of broken tool. You take it out back and you shoot it. Now, from where we stand today, that seems utterly barbaric. And we have laws and organizations that are very much against that kind of interactions with the dog. The dog now has a position in the family which is closer to being another person. We often talk about the dog as being, you know, another member of the family.
I'm going to interrupt you.
Just an object.
Okay, so I'm going to stop you right there because I get that. I grew up in farm in the farm area, and that's what we did with animals. That's the way they were treated. And so people right now are saying, right, but a dog is so much different from a robot. I suspect you're going to tell me that's only because we've gone down that road, and that's the same road we may eventually go down with our robots.
Yeah, it's exactly right. So what I'm going to tell you is that in moving from shooting the dog to treating the dog as a member of the family, the dog has not changed. It's the same species. What's changed is us and the way that we relate to that animal. And with robots that are interactive and social and positioned within the family home, we could evolve very similar kinds of responses that we did to the family dog.
So we make jokes about Rosie the robot on the Jetsons, but that's really kind of almost essentially what we're talking about.
Yeah, it's what we're looking at. And I think, you know, rather than let it happen to us and one day say, oh, my God, how did this occur? I'm so surprised. It's better for us, I think, to ask these questions now and get out in front of the problem so that we respond to it in a way that's reasonable and informed.
The name of the book is Robot Rights. David Gunkel is the author. It's coming out next month. David, listen, I really enjoyed our conversation. I hope we can do it again.
Yeah, I did too. Thanks.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. Marketing can be a tricky beast these days, with so many ways to share a message with an audience. Leveraging pop culture in your business can be one way to do it, but what happens when pop culture leverages your business? Whoa! Meta. Dennis Rodkin of Cranes looked at Chance the Rapper's new album where he refers to Remax, the real estate company, because of a family connection. And according to Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management, that's the best marketing that any business can ask for. He likely wasn't paid for the mention, and he showed that it was a genuine part of his life. Exactly what marketing departments look for. But if you're a farmer, this year was not what you were looking for. The USDA technically declared a disaster in all 102 counties in Illinois due to the wildly unpredictable spring we had this year. The farmers without crop insurance will likely be the first to see the disaster relief money through low-interest loans. Of course, this is in addition to the fact that China is holding out on buying American crops due to the trade war our governments are currently locked in. So that's nice. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch. Here we are on 720 WGN. It's sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. Amy Guth is in the studio.
I'm fighting with a microphone.
Are you okay? Who's winning?
Is it... the microphone's winning.
Okay, so David Gunkel, the professor at NIU, did you listen to any of that?
What an interesting guy. That was an interesting conversation.
I said on the intercom, he just blew my mind.
Yeah.
And I didn't get it until he talked about how we, our relationship with animals. And that is, I think, a perfect way to convey it. You know, it really has changed to where we treat, I mean, people say some people treat animals better than humans now. And, you know, that's been a transformation. And
indeed,
so if we can do that, why might that not happen when it comes to robots? I don't know.
I mean, my grandmother's been saying the robots are, like, as soon as she got a VCR, she's been saying the robots
are taking over.
But she says it like, robot.
Okay, so speaking of taking over, gambling is taking over. Mm. Vice, really, is taking over the state of Illinois. It starts with marijuana.
I think it was just sports betting.
And, ever since the women lost at Evanston, the liquor's come back.
Right.
And now we have casino gambling. And there was this feasibility study that came out today that basically said that the way it's set up now, that it's really not going to be attractive for any investors to come into the city.
Yeah, and I talked to Greg Hines about this story today, and you know, Greg Hines is not one to mince words, of course, so he said it in a very, very funny way. What he said on the podcast was, what surprises me is that the consultant was as frank and as blunt as they were. I mean, they essentially said, hey, General Assembly, why don't you learn to add?
Yeah.
Because I really asked him, hey, what surprised you most about this feasibility study? And he said it was the blunt language, that they were just so like, absolutely not. Is this going to work?
The word everyone looked up and tried to figure out how to pronounce is onerous or onerous.
That's right.
Right?
That's right. Because they really just that's like in the, I think, second or third bullet point in this report. There is a copy of the report at Crane's Chicago Business. You can see it, and it's embedded in Greg's story. You can see it's interesting, but no, they do not mince words in that.
And this follows Mayor Lightfoot earlier this week saying, look, we've got to find, this has got to be economically feasible if we're going to jump in.
That's right. And so the five sites that have been kind of tossed around as possible places for the casino construction, this consultant looked at each one of those and kind of said how it would work at each of these. But the bottom line was that, you know, once the tax starts rolling, it would be up to like 70%
right.
of revenue. Just nobody is going to want to finance this. So, you know, it kind
Let's
of
say
remains
that again.
To be
seen. So the way it's set up, that the casino operator would essentially be handing over almost 70% of revenue to state and local government.
That's right. And so at that point, who in the world is going to finance that? So there's the option, as Greg pointed out, it could be government run, which is what is happening in Detroit.
Oh, I think that would work perfectly.
Oh,
sure.
That what could possibly go wrong with that? That's exactly right. What Greg Hines said. Like, oh, I'm sure some alderman's brother needs a job somewhere, right. You know. So there's that.
Take
I think
that aldermanic privilege.
Right. You know, so yeah, I think the best move would be to have a private casino company run that, obviously, because that's the business they're in. So we'll see.
Mayor Lightfoot is just out with a statement, having seen it or reacting to it. She says, while the study confirms our concerns about the tax structure that the legislature passed, we know this can be addressed, and we look forward to working with the governor and legislative leaders to revise the legislation and ensure a new casino will be beneficial for Chicago.
I mean, it really feels like a told you so. Okay, your move, Pritzker. I mean, it really does. And there's been a lot of speculation on how these two will work together. And Greg Hines and I have talked about that a couple of times on Crane's Daily Gist. And so this might be a big test of their relationship, of how they can reach compromise.
But she didn't throw in the towel either and say it's not going to happen. She said, let's go back and fix it.
Yep, let's fix it.
Well, maybe WeWork could run the casino.
Maybe they could.
Because they run everything else.
They're going to own everything. Okay, so not so long ago, Danny Ecker and I talked about this on the podcast, that WeWork officially signed to have, now they have at least 1 million square feet of office space. Okay.
There aren't many million square feet office holders, right?
There's not.
Yeah.
And they've just signed another lease. So you can add another 90,000 square feet on top of that million.
Wow.
But what's interesting about this lease, it makes their fourth downtown lease, but third in Fulton Market, which is so interesting. Their idea is kind of like, we want to have a couple of spots really close together to give people options. Because they have, if you are familiar with them, in Fulton Market, they've got two right there on Green Street that are just about a block apart. And that seems kind of counterintuitive, like you wouldn't do a Starbucks that way. But the idea
is... Well, no, Starbucks is a bad example, because you would.
You literally would on every single corner. But like the idea is that way you could kind of float among these three offices.
Right,
if I
work in the South Loop, I want to have one close to me. Now, I think there is one near Canal... The train stations, right?
I think it's a safe bet.
Right.
There's one
right.
everywhere. It's like, it's a WeWork or a Starbucks.
But so then why is it that they're focusing or concentrating in Fulton Market?
Because they're betting on how much is happening in Fulton Market. This third one is interesting because it's pretty far west. And so their competitors have gone a little further west in Fulton Market. So now they're kind of saying like, well, all right, we'll go here too. But they want to give people kind of a different environment in the same, like, I'm going to go radio air quotes, campus area, to kind of shift around during the day, where you could go to the more modern one. Maybe one got loud. You could go to one that has a meeting space. You could kind of like pop around the neighborhood.
So when I think of WeWork, initially, I should say, I thought of an individual, you know, a woman who doesn't have an office, a guy who doesn't have an office,
right.
goes, sits there. But more and more, too, the WeWork is leasing out big hunks of space to other companies, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing, and a lot of landlords are kind of scratching their heads over how to keep up with it, because that way you get all these amenities that you don't really have to fund or pay for or provide your employees yourself, especially if you're just a small team. Like, does it make sense to go get an office and pay the water cooler person and the snack machine and all this stuff when you could just rent, you know, a small corner office or maybe just 3 to 7 desks
right.
or something like that, and that's plenty for your team, and you get the conference room and all that kind of stuff. So,
so landlords are worried about that because they might be cramping their style.
That's right.
Amy Guth is the host of The Daily Gist. We'll listen for that a little bit later today.
Thanks so much.